studies. Okay, so today, actually, this is my last lecture, my last day at the workshop. And we heard, well, you know, give a little presentation really on some geological constraints. And then Peter actually set out sort of the governing equations and the basics of mantle convection. And you got to do a simple tutorial, but gain some understanding of the governing equations yesterday and how we solve these equations. Quite aside from this philosophical discussion that Stan and Louise and I had of whether the equations have a solution, right? Whether a solution exists. Okay, so today we're actually going to sort of step back a little bit from the sophistication of yesterday's work, if you wish, to solve the equations and try to solve the equations by making some simple assumptions. And like I said in my first lecture, we're going to trade the sophistication, the ability to do more sophisticated rheology, for example, for some predictive power so that we can do things in three dimensions for the Earth. And this afternoon, we'll do a tutorial based basically entirely on this lecture. And, you know, I still have to make sure that it works correctly here. Anyway, this is the rest of the schedule, but I just wanted to show you how this fits in into the rest. Okay, so with the governing equations that, you know, Peter mentioned already, basically we're trying to solve for the conservation of mass, momentum, and energy, and this term right here, right, the evolution of the velocity. So these are expressed, well, perhaps not in their full glory, certainly, but for compressible flow, if I haven't made any mistakes. And the evolution of, so first let's look at the term. So the conservation of momentum, really this is nothing but dynamical equilibrium. I mean, it's dynamical equilibrium, and in a way, you end up with conservation of momentum that is nothing but F equals ma, but in a continuum sense. Okay. Now, for the Earth, right, because it's a very, very viscous fluid, and Peter showed you this yesterday, 2 days ago, I forget. Because it's a very viscous fluid, inertial forces are not important, so you can get rid of the evolution with time. What that means is that you end up, instead of the Navier-Stokes, which is was shown here, you end up with the Stokes equation, right? So inertial forces are not important, there is no time evolution. So the only way to get the time evolution is to couple with the energy equation. And in applied mathematicians like to say that the velocity field is slaved to the temperature field. Okay, with, of course, conservation of mass thrown in. Now, what is the difficulty here? I mean, Peter showed a lot of the difficulties, I mean, difficulties in solution that are numerical as well. But one of the big difficulties, and I alluded to this in my first presentation, is that what is the right constitutive relation? So here you have the gradients of the stress, and stress is a tensor. So you need to relate the stress to the strain rate, right? So you need to have, you know, a constitutive relation that relates the material properties to the material, how the material is going to respond to deformation. So here's the full stress tensor with the hydrostatic part and the deviatoric part. And this is a very, very simple constitutive relation. This is a linear relationship between stress and strain rate. Actually, that should be an epsilon star. So apparently I can't make a matrix vector with a Greek symbol and whatever stupid Microsoft software I'm using. Okay, so this is very simple. This is a Newtonian relationship, so linear relationship between stress and strain rate. That certainly is not going to work. I showed you a little bit how exotic rheology, it's not really exotic, just simply a nonlinear relationship, can help you in some way to obtain plate-like behavior. Anyway, so we're stuck. I mean, it's very difficult sometimes from first principles to borrow from sort of the condensed matter physics type literature, from first principle, from knowing all the physics, solve the equations and get to the Earth, okay? Now, the other problem that you face, that even if you knew all the physics, which we probably don't, even if you had all the best numerical methods, the fact is that even from first principles, it'd be very difficult to get to the Earth today. And the reason is that all the contingencies of Earth histories or the initial condition of where the Earth started are not something that are accessible to us or that we know. So even if we could solve this system exactly for, you know, the mantle with plates and so on, we will end up with an Earth, as Paul Tackley likes to say, a point in parameter space. We would end up with an Earth, but not our Earth. We wouldn't necessarily predict all the plate tectonic motions and all the evolution of the Earth, okay? So if we try to understand Earth today and some particular observations, perhaps we need to do something a little different. Okay, so what are the methods of solution? And then Peter actually, he showed this and skipped through the, because he didn't have enough time, he skipped through the details on some of the numerical methods. So ask him and ask Louise about all the details. They know a lot more than I do about this. But basically, to solve those equations, so forget, you know, we're going to try to solve those equations, say we know all the material properties, need numerical methods for partial differential equations, and there are many. And in fact, in the computational fluid dynamics community, which is very allied to the applied math community, there's tons of methods that keep being developed, which are very useful for flows that are at finite Prandtl numbers or zero Prandtl numbers, meaning, you know, flows that are in viscous like ours, so sometimes they're not quite as applicable. Anyway, what you need without going into all these details, this is actually from my lecture the last time we had Sider. You need some flexibility, especially if you're going to do plates at the surface. You need flexibility with grids. And actually, if you look at Peter's PowerPoint, he has some, you know, nice notes on, you know, what methods work for giving you the flexibility in the geometry in the grids. You need a lot of resolution, and you found this out yesterday in your tutorial, right? You found out that resolution matters and that you get all sorts of, you know, under-resolved, you know, little plumes in the middle of downwellings and things like that if you're not well-resolved. You have to have the ability of handling very large material property contrasts across grid points and things like that. And of course, you'd like speed, right? You don't want to spend your entire graduate career doing one run. you know, people that do porous flow actually, you know, make funny statements about things like this. And then you want to be able to do global work, but also perhaps regional. Peter showed some work on subduction zones and so on. Okay, and so what you choose will depend on the nature of the problem. And then here again is the constitutive relation problem and the material properties, which have to come from mineral physics, both in terms of static properties and dynamic properties, like rheology. And they're going to be a function of pressure, temperature, composition, and in the case of rheology, stress, strain, rate. Anyway, bottom line, this is difficult, right? Okay, so step back. And let's make some simplification. This is actually applicable to the Earth as a whole. So I'm going to assume already that I have an incompressible Newtonian fluid. So I've dropped all my compressibility stuff. I've already dropped all the inertial forces, all that evolution with time. So I have that the body forces and the pressure gradients are what are going to drive the flow, and they're going to be opposed by the viscous stress term. And what I've done is I've already put in my constitutive relation in, so that now I have things expressed into the Laplacian of the velocity, so there's just a second derivative with respect to space, instead of the gradient of the stresses. Okay. Now, so this is what I end up with. And so what's F? F is the body forces. Thankfully for us, the only body forces we need to worry about for the mantle are gravitational, right? So, you know, I can express this in terms of some delta rho, in the Boussinesq sense that Peter talked about before, you know, other material properties aren't going to vary, and so on. And then this is the gravitational acceleration. So if I know my delta rho, and I can express that all the changes into delta rho are going to be due to changes in the thermal expansion as a function of the changes in the temperature, which are going to be given to me by the energy equation. So the advection diffusion equation, this is the advection of the isotherms, this is the diffusion part. And you'll see actually that you can see that there's, in once you can relate these two, right? So this is the diffusion of momentum and this is the diffusion of the temperature. Okay. But suppose now, so all the energy equation gives you, it's F, right? It's the ability to know what F is and then to evolve F in time. But suppose that you know that delta rho, okay? Suppose that you actually know that. You say, okay, I know that, so I don't need to solve the energy equation. All I need is to solve this, the Stokes equation. Okay, can I do that? Well, you can imagine that for very simple cases, and, you know, this is full on the dynamics textbook, especially Turkin and Schubert, you know, that you can do this. You know, you have a simple geometry, a simple system, you're going to be able to do it. Okay, So let's do one simple example where you actually know the buoyancy. So we're going to look at a falling sphere, okay, so that depicted here, of radius r, which has a density contrast with respect to its surrounding, okay? Well, it's either falling or rising, depending on the density contrast. So what do we have? We have to balance, we have to do that equilibrium, balance the driving forces, which are going to be buoyancy, the gravity, with the resisting forces, which are all going to be due to the viscous stresses surrounding the system, right? So this is very simple, just balance driving and resisting. Okay, so the buoyancy forces is just going to be, well, you know, whatever, the weight of the sphere, right? And this is expressed very simply here. So it's the delta rho times the volume element here to get the delta m. The resistance forces, we're going to say that they are associated with the stresses times the area. So this is the area, the surface area of the sphere. And the stresses here are going to be the viscous stresses. So it's going to be the simple linear relationship between viscosity, between stress and strain rate. Okay. Now, strain rate is nothing but the velocity gradients. And we're actually going to assume, so V over R, you know, we're going to express that strain rate in terms of V over R. We're going to assume that the changes, that is the same scale, that we're going to get the strain rates in the same scale. So changes V is, the length scale of the changes in V will be the length scale of the changes in R, so that we can express it simply here. So now we have that the resisting forces then are this very simple expression. So we now we sum, we get our balance of forces. This is actually basically straight out of Jeff Davies' book, which I recommend greatly. I think in terms of physical insight, it's not as complete as Turkin and Schubert, but I think it explains things very nicely. So we just balance the driving and resisting forces, exactly the same thing we did in the equation before, and we get an expression for the velocity, right? So this is just algebra that we've done now, where the velocity is going to be proportional to the delta rho. That makes sense, right? So the larger the delta rho between the sphere and the surrounding, the faster it's going to go. And it's going to be inversely proportional to the viscosity of the medium in which it's falling or rising, which also makes sense. If this encounters something extremely viscous, right, like, I don't know, the table or something like that, well, it isn't going to move. Okay, well, that's not a good analogy. But if it encounters something like corn syrup, well, you know, it's going to fall at a certain rate and so on. So it makes sense that the driving forces are going to be proportional to the delta rho and the resisting forces to the viscous stresses and the viscosity. Now, the actual proportionality constants here depends on the ratio of the viscosities between the sphere and the surrounding. Okay, so that should give you a sense, right, that it is possible to solve that Stokes equation in a way that it's useful for geology. So this is a very simple simple case right here. So let's apply it. I've chosen some values for the diameter and the delta rho and the viscosity and a plume head rising through the mantle. And, you know, of course, this is going to be uncertain. And for a xenolith rising through magma. And you can see that we can apply this and we get 80 kilometers per million years. This is actually quite a bit slower than the calculations on plumes that Peter showed because he had temperature-dependent viscosity and he also had a compositional element to the buoyancy and so on. And then for a xenolith, it's screaming fast, right, because the viscosity is so slow. So it doesn't take very long at all for a xenolith to come up in a magma. Anyway, this is one way to apply it and gain a little bit of understanding on how these things are used. Okay, so, right, so you thought I wasn't going to show anything more complicated than that. Okay, so now let's do something that it's more useful than that. Okay, so those are very simple geometries, and I can apply it to, you know, I can get analytical solutions to that equation and, you know, I come up with scalings and come up with simple back-of-the-envelope stuff. But now let me do something a little bit more complicated, okay? And they say, I want to solve flow in a self-gravitating Earth, okay? So ours, a self-gravitating planet, actually not just the Earth. So I'm going to take my Stokes equation right here, and I've written in terms of the velocity. I really should have written in terms of the stresses. Because I'm going to do now. And then I've also made an expression for the gravity, for the acceleration of gravity. in terms of, you know, the gradient of a potential. And then I've written Poisson's equation for the gravitational potential, right? So I'm actually going to solve these two things coupled with each other. Okay. Now, I'm not going to give you really all the details. I just want to give you a flavor for how this is done. And the reason I want to give you a flavor for how this is done, besides the tutorial, is that, you know, you go through some algebra, quite a little bit of algebra, but you end up with something that solves flow, as you'll see in a second, in a three-dimensional spherical shell, and allows you to predict velocities and stresses at the surface at any point inside the Earth. So that's pretty useful. Okay. We're going to make one assumption, and we'll see in a second that we know this delta rho, and we'll see where that delta rho comes from. So what is this strategy? Now, what I recommend you do, because without a doubt I won't explain it well, and probably I'll make mistakes, is that you go to Guy's note, SIO 224B, where he's actually derived everything very nicely, and I borrowed liberally with that attribution. So, okay, except for what I just said now. Anyway. So what are we going to do? The first thing that we're going to do is that we're going to realize that we can take each one of the variables, so, you know, say this vector field for the velocity, this scalar field for the density, and so on, and we're going to take each variable and we're going to express it or expand it in terms of spherical harmonics. Scalar spherical harmonics if we're dealing with the pressure and the density, so which looks like that right here. So the delta rho expressed in terms of spherical harmonics will mean a summation over the angular or, you know, ln m over ln m, degree and order of to infinity of some coefficient times these spherical harmonics, which I'll explain in a second. For the vector fields, it's more complicated. You're going to have a radial dependence, and you're also going to have a dependent on co-latitude and longitude, okay? And what you can show is, in fact, that any vector field can be expressed as a sum of these, and where this del 1, this is going to be the horizontal divergence, for the horizontal gradient, okay? For those of you that sort of, you know, think about fluid dynamics, these terms could actually be easily related to the horizontal divergence of the field and the radial vorticity of the field. To go back to my first lectures, they would be the poloidal and toroidal terms. So stuff that is rising or falling and stuff that has shear in it. Okay. Now, so what are spherical harmonics? Perhaps this isn't a perfect analogy, but bear with me. Suppose you had a very complicated curve, you know, with lots of peaks and valleys and so on. So one of the ways you could express that, I mean, you're not going to want to do it with a polynomial, not even with splines. You might want to do it with a Fourier series sum, right? You sum many sines and many cosines, and you'll actually reproduce that very jagged curve that you have. Well, perhaps this isn't a perfect analogy, but spherical harmonics work exactly the same way, but for the surface of the Earth. Because many geophysical observable fields, the geomagnetic field, the gravity field, even the velocity field of the plates, you know, are on the surface of the sphere, it's nice to have a basis function with which to express those fields that then we can manipulate so that we can understand, say, what power there is in the different wavelengths of the field. So why is this useful? I showed you a little bit of the poloidal toroidal stuff. But for example, most of the velocity field of the Earth is dominated by a particular wavelength, which is actually L equals 4, which corresponds to 10,000 kilometers, which corresponds to the size of the Pacific plate. Okay? So what are spherical harmonics? So spherical harmonics are the angular portion of the solution to Laplace's equation. So actually, this looks a lot like Poisson's equation without the source term, right? It is, in fact. and so you can show that this you can solve by separation of variables. And the angular parts, the solutions are the YLMs, which have, you know, this normalization factor in front. Then these are called the associated Legendre polynomial, which depend only on colatitude. And the phi dependence, or the longitude dependence, comes only in this term, which has an imaginary term, EIM phi. Okay. Now, these have beautiful properties because, remember, we're going to take each one of those variables and expand it, and then we're going to take those variables and I'm going to put them back into the equations. But look at this. So the Laplacian, or the horizontal Laplacian of the YLM, is this really simple expression. So every time I take derivatives, I can take advantage of the relationships between spherical harmonics. And the phi derivative is really trivial. Okay, so I think that's pretty cool. Okay, so now I want to show you this cool website that I found on spherical harmonics. Here it is. Okay, so basically this is going to show you, this is going to show you what spherical harmonics look like for different degree and order. Okay, so degree L, order M. So this is going to give you the zonal part, so that it's going to control, you know, sort of the longitude part, and this, you know, will control the co-latitude part. And you see here that they are, expressed in different terms. We're only going to use that part right here. So here's degree 0, 0, okay? So actually, Barbara showed this, and Guy also showed this. Right, so here, degree 0, 0, well, you know, it's a homogeneous along the Earth, for example. So for the velocity field of the Earth, for the kinematic velocity field of the Earth, a degree 0 would correspond to, actually an Earth expansion, so an Earth that it's breeding, okay? Now, suppose that we now have degree 1 and 0. Okay, so in the plate velocity field, this would correspond to, say, having a ridge on one side and a subduction zone on the other. So you would have, you know, something that, you know, has a divergence in this sense and the convergence in that sense. Okay, so this is degree 1, 0. So then, you know, you can see now that the zonal part with the M's are going to come in. If I make M1, now I'm going to have a variation right here because we've included an M equals 1 effect. Now, one of the things that's most important for the Earth in terms of the heterogeneity is the degree 2 pattern. Okay, so here's what degree 2, 0 looks like, for example. Okay, and here's what degree 2, 1 looks like. So you have this alternation of positive, negative, positive, negative. So for example, the distribution of continents and ocean pretty much approximates a degree 2, 2, 0, and so on. Okay, so that's what those patterns mean. Okay, so the relationship between the order, the harmonic degree and order actually has an expression in the pattern that you see at the surface. Okay, so I talked about the poloidal. A toroidal degree 1, for example, would be one hemisphere of the Earth rotating with respect to the other hemisphere of the Earth. Okay, so let's go back to... this is not quite as easy as it seems. Okay. Oops. So I guess it doesn't let me go back to exactly where I was. Okay, so now continuing. So let me just back, oops. See, this is what happens when you try to be too clever. So I want my notes in front of me without you seeing them. And see, that's what's causing all my problems. Okay. All right, so we take each of the variables, expand them in spherical harmonics in the appropriate way, and now we're going to take each one of those expansions like this, and we're going to put them into these equations. So we're going to take the expansion for delta rho, for V, and so on, and we're going to put them in these equations, and we're going to take all the appropriate derivatives, which are going to be so easy for us because of spherical harmonic properties. Okay, so here's one example. So these are the components of the velocity field, okay? Remember, that's a vectors field, so we're using the vectors for harmonics, and we're using those three terms that I showed before. So for the radial field, we just have one component, ALM, times the YLM. For V theta and V phi, we have different, you notice that we have two different coefficients right here. That corresponds to the poloidal part, and this corresponds to the toroidal part, okay? Or the divergence and the vorticity of the system. And then, you know, this little notation here, the comma theta means is the derivative of the YLM with respect to theta, and the comma phi is the derivative of the YLM with respect to phi. Okay, so how do I substitute them into the equation. Well, here's one example. Here's the easiest by far. And this is what the continuity or the mass conservation equation looks like. So now this, you know, the radial part of the field, it looks like this. And then we have this very simple expression. It only depends on the poloidal coefficients, for example. And this dot here represents actually a spatial derivative in this notation rather than a temporal derivative. Okay, so if we do that, if we substitute the expansions for velocity, stress, pressure, and density, you end up with six couple ordinary differential equations, okay, which you can solve numerically, and certainly people do. But actually, if you perform a variable substitution, you collect all the coefficients, you know, call the coefficients, say, y, and when there is a, they're going to be divided by r and by eta naught when it's the stresses. Well, you perform the simple substitution and then collect all those coefficients into a vector, okay? And then you get these nicely defined matrix differential equations. So this is, you know, simple enough differential equation, except that this is a vector and this is a matrix, okay? And the nice thing about the fact that these are linear and that we've performed this expansion and that the vector fields have this property of having the radial, the poloidal part, and the toroidal part is that the poloidal and the toroidal equations completely decouple from each other so that you can write two separate differential equations, one for the poloidal field and one for the toroidal field. Now, this is only going to affect the velocities and the stresses. Well, this actually is going to come in also in the part that has to do with the gravitational potential of the Earth. And so what's great about this? What's great about this is that this you can show that they have analytical solutions, okay? These are called Volterra equations of the second kind or something like that. And you can show that they have a solution that looks like this, where y of l equals p of a, the propagator matrix, of p of a at angular order l, lambda to lambda naught, where lambda is just the log of the radius you're at to the radius of the Earth, times y naught plus this integral right here. And what's great about that? That you take advantage of the continuity of velocity and stresses at each of the layers so that you can propagate your solution from one layer to the other. So I can have different properties in different layers, at least in the radial sense, because I can propagate the solution from any position to the next position and so on until I get to the surface of the Earth or the core mantle boundary. And you can do this, you can solve for the velocities and stresses at the surface, any point in the Earth, or the core mantle boundary once p is known. And for p, there are expressions that are of the form, the exponential of the matrix A times, you know, the radius and some other things. Okay, and I'm not going to show you either A or B or any of that. Okay, now you're still not done, because you have six, you know, you have the differential equation, so you need boundary conditions. I've already told you there's continuity of velocity and stresses at boundary interfaces. But you also need to pick, and I want you to remember this, you need to pick boundary conditions for the core mantle boundary and for the surface. Okay. So core mantle boundary is easy because the core is underneath, you know, it's liquid, it's probably largely inviscid, you know, as we can see it. So that's going to be a free slip boundary condition, meaning that there are no shear stresses on that boundary. Okay, cool enough. Right, but what to do at the surface? What do you pick for the surface? So if you pick the very surface of the Earth with air or water, what would you pick? Free slip? Would shear stresses be zero? Would that be the same as the core? So its air has the same viscosity as the core? Probably less, right? We'll get to that. So you could pick the surface, free slip, right? And in principle, if you really, really were solving things well, that's what you should pick because, you know, the top surface. But the fact is that the Earth has plates, and that's very difficult to do. So you pick a no-slip condition, meaning that there are shear stresses, and you do so so that it is at the bottom of the lithosphere. And sometimes you introduce, you know, the more complicated thing that is still a no-slip condition, but you let it slip at a particular velocity, and that's the plate velocity boundary condition. Now, why do I even mention this? I want to show you in a second. So I'll let you in on a dirty little secret. When we solve for the geoid, we use a free slip boundary. When we solve for plate velocities, we use no slip conditions. And the fact of the matter is, we can't match the geoid if we choose no slip, and we can't match the plate motions if we choose free slip. So I'll show you that in a second. Anyway, we'll come back to that. Okay, now I'm done with equations. Well, almost. Because I haven't shown you all the details. But the fact is that you can get to the solutions that are very fast. And you end up computing mantle flow. So for example, this is a tomographic model. I've assumed I've known that delta rho, right? I have computed my velocities and converted to density. I didn't compute the velocity, someone else did. And converted them to density. And now I can calculate the velocities. So if I assume that all the blues are cold and all the reds are hot, this should induce downwellings right here, and this should induce upwellings right here. And you can see it in the arrows of the velocity. So I'm able to compute flow anywhere in the entire three-dimensional shell of the mantle. Okay, so what are the advantages? Okay, so the advantages is that because it's based on spectral solutions, or spectral harmonics, or you can call it spectral, it's very fast, and you'll see that in a second. You can change the radial viscosity profile, explore the effects of viscosity structure. It's a spherical shell, and you can predict several observable fields. Geoid, topography, we'll mostly concentrate on geoid today, plate motions, flow, and try to compare it to anisotropic observations, and so on. You can also explore compressibility. You can modify all these equations to include compressibility, you know, add the terms to the propagator. It turns out that at long wavelengths, the effect is less than 10%. Okay, so effectively, you can explore the effect of phase transition. But what are some of the problems? Is that there is a lack of rheological complexity. There are no lateral viscosity variations or plate boundary rheology. And so this is an issue, and we'll explore that in a second. There's no time dependence. So all it's giving you is a one snapshot of the field right now. But I think perhaps the biggest problem, besides the boundary conditions in a second, is that we must assume a density heterogeneity field. And how do you do that? Okay, so now what? Okay, so now I've said, okay, I know the delta rho. I'm not going to bother with the energy equation. And I'm going to do all my setup, and I'm going to solve for flow. But where is my delta rho coming from? Well, really, this field sort of exploded in 1985. Brad Hager and Adam Zawanski published a paper using Adam's well, certainly not first, but his tomographic models, and said, let's take the velocity field, this three-dimensional velocity anomaly field from tomography, convert to density, and compute the flow. Okay, how do you do that? Well, that's not as trivial as it sounds, and you can do other things, which we'll talk about in a second. Okay, so for a long time, what we did is when we computed the velocity field with the density anomalies, is we use a constant. We use Birch's law. This is illustrated here. This is from Lars's paper in Geophysical Journal International, the shear wave velocity as a function of density. And these are different mantle minerals. And these are lines of constant atomic weight. Okay? And you can see, you know, there are systematics for different weights, but essentially they fit a straight line, which would mean that there's a very simple relationship between velocity and density. And in fact, in this particular plot right here, it ends up being about 0.5. And so, in fact, the factors that people have used in the past for converting velocity to density based on mineral physics experiments and so on is between 0.1 and 0.5 grams seconds per kilometer centimeter cubed. Okay. This is all I use. As a matter of fact, I always use a constant factor. But the fact of the matter is that we know it can't be a constant factor. Okay, so this particular plot, and people, you know, like Carato, have tried to come up with much better velocity density scalings, or at least more complex ones. And in this particular case, you know, he is shown here, this is a terrible reproduction, so depth on the horizontal axis, and d log rho, d log vs, at a particular depth on the vertical axis right here. Okay. Now, if you assume that the variations of density and of velocity are only with temperature, you come up with a relationship like this, where d log rho dt times d log vs dt to the minus 1, you know, this is all you need to know. Okay, and all the all that you have to worry about are the effects of thermal expansion. Okay, so I think that the top is basically doing that. Okay, just that. But what you have to worry about is, as soon as there's temperature issues or as soon as you're dealing with VS, is attenuation and elastic effects, which we've already talked about. Colleen showed some of the results and how much attenuation there is. So that decreases the value significantly. Okay, so Carato published a paper in 1993 with a velocity density scaling that included the effects of anelasticity. Okay, and it was very influential. In fact, Gina Namesis used it for forever, in fact, until a couple years ago. But it turned out that actually that was wrong. So he's updated that now based on more mineral physics information. Okay, now you see here that this factor right here never goes negative, right? Okay, and it never goes negative, and that's the claim, you know, just due to the temperature field. But that's not so, and you saw that when you did the tutorial in mineral physics, because phase transformation can actually make the thermal expansion go negative. And this is the expression that Lars has shown, where there is the effect due to temperature and then the effect due to the phase transitions right here. Okay? So in fact, this can be very spiky, and I'll show you that in a second. Okay, so velocity density scaling is likely our biggest problem, okay, together with boundary conditions. Okay, so let's apply this. Let's apply this to very simple, well, not very simple, to a particular problem, to a particular observable, which is the geoid, so that we can try to learn something about the viscosity structure of the Earth. Okay, so here is sort of schematically represented, represented what a geoid anomaly, what the geoid anomaly signal would be like. So I have this little blob that it's denser than its surrounding. If I only looked at the effect of the excess mass, I would get a positive geoid anomaly, right? Then actually I also have to add in the effects of self-gravitation. Some of the material is going to be attracted from the side, so the surface of the Earth is going to bulge up a little bit. The effect of self-gravitation is important at long wavelengths, really up to about 2 degree 4, which is, you know, about 10,000 kilometers. You know, maybe a little bit more. It cannot be ignored for the geoid, because most of the power of the geoid is at low degrees, okay? We'll see that in the tutorial. The biggest is degree C to 0 for the geoid. So self-gravitation is certainly important, and you can't ignore it. And so that's one of the difficulties we have, is if we try to do this with the numerical mental convection codes, is, you know, some of them don't include self-gravitation, and so we have to have corrections for that later on. Okay, so if you were just dealing with the mass, right, this is what you would get. But you can also have to deal with the dynamics, and this was the insight, you know, in the 1980s from Ricard and Fredevaux and Hager and Richards, is that if you have a mass in a viscous fluid or Stokes flow, it's actually going to induce viscous flow. That flow, it's going to deflect the surface, and it's going to change the distribution of the mass of the surface, because you're going to now replace what was before solid Earth with either water or air if this is sinking, or if it was rising, you would get a different, you know, the opposite sense, and you would replace air or water with mass. So if in the dynamic effect, you deflect the surface downwards, and now you have a negative anomaly. The total geoid anomaly has to be the sum of this effect plus this effect, okay? Now, I haven't illustrated here that, you know, we also have a core mantle boundary, and that's also going to get deflected as well because of dynamics, and it's also there's going to be a mass, and that's taken into account. Okay. Now, so what can we do? So what we can do is try to formally account for these two parts, the parts due to the excess mass and the part due to the dynamics. And so formally separate the structure. So this is written here. This is the geoid anomaly as a function of L and M. And what we can do is, you know, calculate the part that is, you know, the delta rho here, part that is due to the excess mass, and then also the part that is due to the dynamics. And then we end up constructing a kernel, or the response to that mass anomaly. And a particular part of the Earth, the Green's function, so is the geoid anomaly due to a unit density anomaly, really, it's not a point source, of wavelength L at depth R, okay? And then we can sum all of these together and come up with what the geoid anomaly is at the surface of the Earth. Okay, now, why do we worry so much about the dynamical contribution? Okay, well, this contribution, you know, you would have known how to calculate in a static earth without any problems. This contribution depends on flow. And if it depends on flow, it's going to depend on the viscosity structure. So the kernels, or the Green's functions, that determine that dynamical response also depend on viscosity structure. And what you can show, and this is what, you know, Hager and Richter show, and there's a nice paper by Hager in 1989 where this is illustrated, is that in fact the sign of the geoid kernel changes as a function of depth and depending on viscosity structure. So what's illustrated here is the sign of the geoid kernel, so that response, right, as a function of harmonic degree, from harmonic degree 2 to harmonic degree 6. These are figures from Lana Panasiuk. And you can see here that it's actually changing sign. This is for a viscosity structure where the lower mantle is 50 times more viscous than the upper mantle. And so you can see here how it's changing sign right here. And this is why, even if you have a density excess, like a slab, you can actually get a negative geoid anomaly, which was a puzzle for a long time. Now, these are the kernels for the dynamic topography, and clearly, the kernels for the dynamic topography don't have that effect. They don't change. They're always negative, because a mass excess always causes a deflection. And you see also that they lose power, meaning they're not as important as you go deeper into the Earth. So this is dynamic topography at the surface. The further removed you are from the surface, the less the effect of the deflection on the surface, which, you know, makes sense. Okay, so now let's apply this. So this is all pretty standard theory. I'll actually upload the readings that are necessary, you know, for you to do. This has been shown before. So let's now take the flow and predict the geoid. Okay. So here's one prediction of the geoid. This is the observed geoid from degrees 2 to 15, and this is a predicted geoid. I have chosen a viscosity structure where the lower mantle is 50 times more viscous than the upper mantle. I actually have a lithosphere here. It's really not that meaningless, especially because it's a very, you know, lower viscosity. It only illustrates the fact that the lithosphere is mobile. And so there is, you know, certain correspondence to this. The correlation coefficient to the variance reduction is very high. This was not done with tomography, okay? I didn't have to assume anything about the velocity-density scaling. Is done with a density heterogeneity model that is based on the history of subduction, which Guy hates, so we won't, and Adam also, so we won't go there. Okay, so the geoid, so we now are using our flow to predict an observable like the geoid, and if we can predict the observable and fit to the observations, since it depends on the viscosity structure, maybe we can learn something about the viscosity structure of the Earth, okay? So what other observations tell us about viscosity structure? Postglacial rebound. Okay, true. Postglacial rebound, which depends directly on the absolute viscosity and also on the viscosity structure. The geoid does not depend on absolute viscosity at all, only on the structure of the viscosity. Okay, so how robustly do we know it? Okay, so there are Alex Forte and Jeremy Trevita. They've taken joint inversions for the gravity field and postglacial rebound data, and they have calculated a viscosity structure, their best fitting viscosity structure. This is depth here, and this is the viscosity right here, or the viscosity contrast with respect to 10 to the 1 ion Pascal second as a function of depth. And you see this is a very complicated structure compared to, say, what I'm using, which looks more like this dashed line there. So is this resolvable? Well, no. So the viscosity structure is not robust. And this is an illustration here. This is from the master's thesis of Mark Wenzel. So this is log lower mantle viscosity contrast versus log of the transition zone viscosity contrast. And this is a map or a contours of viscosity of a variance reduction or correlation coefficient or whatever. Well, the point is that there's a very, very long range of viscosity structures that give you the exact same correlation coefficient, okay? And that is because you can trade off what you do in the different layers. I make this layer very stiff, extremely stiff, say, and then I put a very tiny little layer here, and I make it very, very inviscid, and I get the same correlation coefficient. So this is a natural part of the theory that it just doesn't care for that. Okay, this is another illustration of why it's not robust. This is also from the master's thesis of Mark Quenzel. And this is all the tomographic models that we had, I don't know, 2000, 2001. And, you know, let's see if I can identify scripts in here. Guy, help me out. SB something, one of those. That's a Ritima, okay. And then Adam, are you here? Help me out. MK12, those are, okay. So actually this, we've used the bulk models here, the bulk sound viscosity models. We've used VS and VP. Okay, and here we're actually optimizing each one individually for the viscosity structure. And we have not cared at all whether they fit very well or very poorly or anything like that. But the fact is that there are two classes of models. Well, some that want a stiff transition zone, this is lithosphere transition zone, lower mantle, and some that want a weak transition zone. And you can see that if you want a weak transition zone, you have a stiff lower mantle, and if you want a strong transition zone, you have a weak lower mantle. Again, trade-offs between viscosity and layer. So it's not robust, and about the only thing you can say, and perhaps not even that, is that there is a viscosity increase at some point in the Earth. Okay. So what about the issues that we can't cover, like the lateral viscosity variations? What are the effects of lateral viscosity variations in the geoid? Without showing you, I told you that the effects of compressibility at long wavelengths, which is really all that matters for the geoid, are small, at about 10%. Okay, so this is the work of Shattuck and Flatou. This is a map of the lateral viscosity variations that they've input. There's North America right there. This is the log of the viscosity. This is the observed geoid. And these are the predicted geoids without no lateral viscosity variation, and this is with lateral viscosity variation. Starting from a tomographic model, I would assume, or a tomographic model modified by some slabs in the upper mantle or something like that. Well, I'd say that to first order, there's no difference between these two. And actually, this was shown by Mark Richards in 1986, 87, thereabouts. You can modify the theory. So right now, part of the theory is that each the response of each wavelength, of each angular order L, depends only on the density at that L, right? If you do coupling between the different wavelengths, you can actually start solving for lateral viscosity variations, because lateral viscosity variations means that density heterogeneity at other wavelengths is going to impact it's going to impact your response. Anyway, the effects are small, and it can be shown here that they're small. That is not true at short wavelengths, and we already saw that in the first lecture when we looked in the geoid and topography of our subduction zones, where in fact we saw that there was a strong effect of lateral viscosity variations, whether it was a low viscosity zone over the slab or a very weak slab. Okay. But let's get back to the issue of the velocity-density scaling, okay? So Lars showed this before. So lateral heterogeneity on the Earth, or lateral variations in velocity, are going to depend on temperature, are going to depend on composition, and they also are going to depend on phase transitions, right? So, and he actually showed you some of the results with phase transition. This is a slide I showed before. And the fact is that the presence of phase transformations means that you can get negative response between the velocity and the density. And so here is my first attempt using that code that you use for your tutorial on the mineral physics, one of the mineral physics tutorials, to compute the d log rho d log vs as a function of depth, including the effects of phase transitions. And, you know, for the most part, it actually stays positive, but then there's this big spike, you know, associated with 660. And then it decreases because of the thermal expansion dependence on with pressure in the lower mantle. And if there were phase transitions in the lower mantle, then this would be more spiky. And you see also a dashed line right here, and that's the effect of anelasticity. What all I did is add a seismological Q model to this right here, and sort of damping out some of these big spikes, but you know, they're still there. So at least for the upper mantle, you know, it is important perhaps to include the effects of phase transitions. Whether, you know, when you are using your tomographic models, you know, something that is this thin actually can be seen, perhaps it doesn't really matter to have it there or not. But even if you aren't including the effect of phase transitions, one of the things that you will see, and actually Lars showed a slide like this, is that one of the things that you will see is that the baseline of the, you know, even without including the spikes, the baseline tends to change because of the latent heat effects, which are either cooling or heating the adiabat. So it is important to include the effects of phase transitions, even if you are not including the individual spikes. Okay, so let's go back to boundary conditions. Okay, let's go back to boundary conditions because I showed you some geoid, and actually the figure I really wanted to show is from a paper by Catherine Touraval and Mike Pritchard, but I couldn't find it. And it's the fact that, you know, we talked about viscosity structure, we talk about compressibility, we talk about a lot of viscosity variations, but the most important thing in solving our equations is that we cannot get the right boundary condition. So for example, this is all from the work on Chadwick and Flatow. So, you know, layering coefficient, I am assuming here, that has to do with the viscosity structure in the lower mantle. And here's the variance reduction. And depending on what they chose, free slip or plate motion, they get very different results, right? And so, you know, they have a point where they coincide. But the fact of the matter is that you make an actual 2D contour map. The biggest, by far, the biggest uncertainty in knowing the viscosity structure, it's not any of the other issues, but it's whether you have chosen the right boundary condition. Now, the Earth has plates without a doubt, right? But the plate boundary condition, the piecewise velocity, you know, of the velocities, doesn't do a very good job. You know, they've actually, I think, done something very strange here to get such a high variance reduction with the plate motions. It usually doesn't give you that. Okay, and free slip is the one that gives you by far the largest, but it doesn't resolve very well what that viscosity structure might be. So this is actually a fundamental issue that it's sort of buried out there, and people revisit occasionally, but you know, we don't come with a resolution. Okay, so bottom line is that these instantaneous flow models are easy to use. You know, they're, you know, relatively fast to code, run very fast, and they can tell you something about observables, but some fundamental issues remain, particularly in adding material properties that are correct in terms of the velocity density scaling and understanding the transition zone better, for example. Okay, I was also going to talk about other examples, which is topography, stresses, plate motions, but I'm actually not going to do that. And I'm going to illustrate how fast the code runs. This is a well, actually, there's the code. Okay, so I need to do something else because I can't watch these stuff at the same time. Okay, so let's run the code and let's see. Let's use a tomographic. I only have one available right here. So run geoid, and it asks you. You want to use the slabs model? If you like me, you'll say yes. If you like seismologist, you'll say no. So use tomography. There it is, done. That's pretty good for correlation coefficient. Okay. Do you want to change the this was written by Yannick Ricard, partly by me, partly by Brad Hager. So, you know, it's got a lot of stuff in French. So you'll have to know we unknown to do the tutorial. Okay. So now wait a second, what did I do wrong? So anyway, the code ran. Well, how long did it take? A few seconds? Okay. So it's going to ask you again because I did this wrong. And, bad. Very bad. That's likely because I've screwed up on the tomography, but it doesn't matter. And then now we should get a map. What it's doing, everything is calculated in spherical harmonics. Now I want to make a map. I have to reconstruct the field spatially. So that's what it's doing right now. Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay. Now it's running GMT. Now something pops up and it has the wrong scale. But, you know, that's the observed geoid and this is, whatever. I don't actually know what tomographic field I've used and what velocity density scaling I've used. And it's not the slab model. And I clean up this between now and 2 o'clock. Okay, but I mean, it runs very fast and you can explore lots of different viscosity structures. So that should be interesting to see. Okay, that's it. I'm gonna stop right there. Questions, I guess. Vertical resolution. So, you know, you set a number of layers, right? You can set the number of layers for the density to as many as you want. I happen to have 20, but you can set 40, 50, whatever. There's no, I mean, it's not an issue of resolve. You don't resolve anything radially. Now, your spatial resolution depends on the spherical harmonic degree to which you choose to do your calculation. And these were done as spherical harmonic degree 20. So that would be 2,000 kilometers. Well, absolutely, absolutely. And so I guess that was my point. You really see something like that if it's very sharp. You know, if it's on the order of 5 kilometers, well, you know, it won't matter if the particular density field that you're using doesn't have a 5 kilometer resolution. So absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry. Right, that's only part of the problem, because those Chadwick and Flatu results and even the Terevan and Richards had lateral viscosity variations, probably not enough, and probably not the plate boundary resolution. So that's part of the problem, but it's not the only part of the problem. Then the other thing that you're left with is, which I didn't show, in the plate motions you use a piecewise continuous velocity field and you get great matches to the plate velocities. You use that same exact flow, that same exact viscosity structure, that same exact boundary condition and your match to the geoid is disastrous. And that's what I mean by an inconsistency and problem with the physics. And it is, one perhaps is more sensitive to lateral viscosity variations than the others, but it's not the only reason. And one of the reasons is that a piecewise continuous velocity field on top of a fluid, that it's Newtonian, it's not a good idea, right? And which is... No, I mean, I see what you're saying. You know, you actually can run calculations where you make an extremely viscous layer at the top. I mean, that's not a problem, right? You can set it. I mean, it's a little artificial because your plates are actually infinitely thin. So having, you know, a lithosphere doesn't actually mean anything. So you just give it some viscosity that it's an approximation over, you know, an averaging of the viscosity of the entire lithosphere. But you can do that. You can make a very viscous lithosphere, and you can get the, you know, and a sthenosphere to say, and decouple the flows. It still doesn't help you. And the problem is that you need, for something like the geoid, you need to match the low degrees to get it right. And matching the low degrees to get it right means you need to get a signal from the flow from the deep structure. And you can't do that if you decouple the flow from the top completely. That's part of the problem. Yes. So viscoelastic, say, something like that? Well, there's certainly viscoelastic. So people that do post-glacial rebound, where they have to worry about the temporal signal, the transient temporal signal, do this, have to do this, because they have to look at the deformation of the lithosphere itself. In the context of these, and then being able to predict the geoid, no, there's no viscoplastic results that I know of, because, you know, then you kind of lose the power and speed of that. And you have to go, in fact, we can go to something numerical. An instantaneous numerical flow code, actually SITCOM does this all the time, but it is not self-gravitating, so it doesn't match the low degrees correctly. So, you know, you have to make sure that you've got all your physics right. Adam. Well, okay, so I actually didn't plot all the C2 zeros for all the models. Well, okay, so maybe that was an exaggerated response last time. There is, in general, and that's why they don't have as high correlation coefficients, yes, they tend to give less C2 zeros than they should. So there is a problem. Now, I also can't guarantee that the Berkeley model still gives a good C2 zero, because I haven't tried anything in the last 5 years. So. Yes, Len.
Your published paper
Yes. Well, so that depends on the interpretation of the tomographic field. So I actually did that with many different tomographic models. And because they all have low velocity anomalies under Africa, and those almost all of them show velocity anomaly that continues into the upper mantle, then you know, if you interpret that as thermal, you always get a dynamic topography that can explain the uplift, you know, the general pattern for South Africa. But if part of that anomaly is compositional, as the sharp gradients would indicate, say, you know, the work of you know, Helmberger and his co-workers, then you have to partition some of the signal into the compositional signal and into the thermal signal. At that point, you lose the ability to drive flow, you know, very effectively upwards. You'll still get a signal if there's mass transfer between lower mantle and upper mantle, but, you know, couldn't put my hand on the fire on the final result. I will say that there's nothing lithospheric that can explain that residual signal, in my opinion. Nico. Okay, well, assuming that I could do my flow at the wavelengths of those little features, then, you know, you wouldn't get necessarily, you know, you wouldn't get necessarily one strong pattern for all of the South African craton or something like that. But most of the flows, so what happens with the flows is that even if you have a lot of short wavelength features, you'll average them out at the long wavelengths and get, you know, an overall deflection of the surface, you know, from all the little contributions. Adam. Yeah.
A comment on that.
Yeah.
Question. Certainly, in case of the African supercontinent, the study of Helmberger and his showed that it's a continuous feature over 1,000 or 2,000 kilometers. So it could not be an aggregation of small tunes or some other.
Yeah.
So that's very important. In addition to the sharpness of it, it also is
It is, and you know, and they showed a pretty continuous blob. Now, the other thing is that for the uplift of South Africa, Lev, the parts that we saw contributing to the Southern Africa was only the part in the lower mantle up to 800 kilometers. And then assuming again that there is mass transfer between lower mantle and upper mantle. And it's only the stuff between 700 and 300 kilometers that contributes to the Eastern African part. So you actually, all you need is that some of that translate into thermal buoyancy to get some signal, assuming that, of course, that there is no complete layering in between. Tom?
So for the velocity, density, or velocity temperature scaling,
mm-hmm.
aside from the spikiness, so sort of average that out, how does your result compare with the Corrado-type model? And also, how might your results influence interpretation of tomographic models in terms of temperature?
Well, okay, I actually haven't tried it, so I don't know. So this is actually plotted slightly differently, but so, you know, so forget the spikiness, you know, there's still this trend down, right? Except that, you know, whatever derivatives that Corrado assumed, this is, he actually gets a much steeper sense, so that he would actually de-emphasize some of the lower mantle stuff. And what I've seen, the people that have used the Corrado and Karki scalings, they actually tend to have very different, you know, not very different, but more complex viscosity structures, because to match the geoid, they no longer have the heterogeneity down here really giving a contribution. It comes from the fact that he has both the derivatives on the elastic part and much stronger inelasticity for the, or much stronger effects on the inelasticity of the lower mantle. What I was trying to say before, how it affects interpretational tomography, lots of people are now using that Karatuan car key. You know, I would say that there are so many other things we don't know that we should be careful. But what I was trying to say is that because of the latent heat release, not only do you get the spikiness, but the overall baseline actually is lowered, so that you get you would get a different factor, even if you didn't account for the spikiness. And actually, Lars had a better figure than this to show it. But the lower mantle here, you know, where there's very little actually going on, and so I would say that this is a more accurate representation. And so this would not probably, it would probably tend to give you the same overall results for the geoid. There are a couple of things that I forgot to mention that I should. Okay, so let's go to any tomographic model here, really. Another important thing in flow models, when we use tomography. Okay. Oops. So this is, you know, I don't even know what depth this is, but okay, but if we were at shallow depths, and you saw this before, very strong anomalies on continents, especially in cratons. This is not the right depth right here. So those we know are compositional, right? So most of the time, when you use tomographic models, you actually strip the top 300 kilometers completely from your results. So you get absolutely no contribution from the top 250 to 300 kilometers to the flow, whether it's for plate motions or for tomography, because you don't have the right velocity density scaling for the compositional part, okay? So that means that we wouldn't get any signals for the short wavelength part contributions or the compositional contributions to the geoid. Yannick Ricard with one of his students recently, they showed something very nice, which was a decomposition of the geoid signal from degrees 2 to 10, and then 10 and above. And you can show that the sort of shallower part and crustal signals all to the geoid anomalies all come from degrees 10 and above. So we're okay for the very low degrees stripping that off, but probably not okay overall. And certainly probably not okay for plate motion stuff. That's something I forgot to mention. Oh, and while I'm at it, let me show you something else, which is interesting, although I haven't made the argument here, so I won't reproduce it completely. But one thing that you can't see here is that there is a difference between P and S models. So S models, you know, which are affected by attenuation and anisotropy and so on and whatever, actually you use a constant conversion factor and your fits to the geoid are pretty darn good, you know, give or take that C2-0 problem. And the P models are terrible, essentially. And so that's interesting, actually, and that has to do with some of the behavior of the bulk modules and the shear modules as a function of temperature. So that d log rho, d log vs, so the d rho dt and the dvs dt actually are sort of linearly track each other, while the bulk modulus doesn't. I mean, it keeps increasing with pressure, and the temperature has a relative little effect on it. So that might be one of the reasons why you get that result. I suppose I should publish that. Here, actually, I think, no, that So it's not that these are all P models and these are all S models, for example. There's actually a combination of them in the two sides. For whatever the structures are in these tomographic models or and so on, some of them prefer to have a weak transition zone and a stiff lower mantle, and some of them prefer to have a strong transition zone and a weak lower mantle. Well, I mean, we were not attempting to make a quality statement about tomography. We were just attempting to say that you need to be careful with robustness. I'm sure I do. Especially, I don't know, I shouldn't use bulk sound velocity models at all, but that's not. But I think even if you remove the ones you don't like, you still have this problem of weak and strong transition zones. I mean, unless you can tell me, you know, in all these colors, you can identify all the ones in it.
Is it possible that
this one is different
from the
rest? So the tensorial properties of viscosity. Well, people don't think so, but not know that we know so. I mean, especially for the lithosphere, I wouldn't put it. You know, I wouldn't say that that's not the case. That you would have some dependence, some anisotropy in viscosity. For the mantle, I think that would be harder to say. Yes, Ben. Lithosphere, transition zone, and lower mantle. So this is which factor gives you, this is the combination of viscosity structure, so that how many times the lithosphere is stronger than the upper mantle, the transition zone, and the lower mantle, that gives you the best correlation coefficient for that given tomographic model. Matt. Yeah, actually, this is plotted over Africa as opposed to the Pacific, which is an. No, I think this is the only observed geoid I have. With lateral viscosity variations. Well, so there's, you know, there's geoid highs here, right? And there's this, generalized geoid highs here. Well, if you believe that the majority of the flow in the mantle is due to subducted buoyancy, then you get this very strong influence from subduction zones and the dynamic topography associated with that. And then you get, over here, you get return flow, passive return flow, that deflects the surface upward and gives us high geoids in this region as well. Now, for here and for here, for sure, it can be just passive return flow because we know from seismology that there's very strong buoyancy of whatever kind associated with the velocity anomalies that they see. Here, you know, actually, I don't have a good explanation for that. It could be related. You know, certainly the, you know, the argument of the slabs breaks down over here because there's been some continuous subduction under South America, interrupted, much more interrupted than under North America and under Eurasia. So why there's so little dynamic topography contribution showing up here due to slabs, I don't know. But here's another interesting problem. I mean, so now we have really good observed geoid models, you know, with all the satellites and, you know, to very high degrees and so on. Actually, don't know how good the resolution is at the poles, but you see this for Antarctica right here. So there's been subduction under Antarctica. Certainly, it hasn't been by any means continuous. You know, the plate tectonic reconstructions are complicated. But if you actually do the residual topography of Antarctica, you remove the ice, and you know, you assume that you know something about the crustal thickness and so on. Well, it turns out that you would get a residual high, which, doesn't jive with this, because if there's been continuous subduction, you'd get a negative dynamic topography. So how do you get, you know, a residual high on the topography and a geoid low? So Antarctica and actually Greenland, for that matter, are actually two very interesting places. When even removing the ice contribution, you end up with something that you don't expect. Well, I'm going to guess that they took maybe surface wave tomography. Actually, I haven't read this paper in a while. And they, from the velocity, they assumed something about the temperature. And then, you know, from the temperature, they did temperature dependence of viscosity or something like that. It's how most people do it. But they use the tomography to give them sort of the thickness of the cratons or things like that, and then they assume an age. From the age, they assume a thermal structure. From the thermal structure, they assume then they get a viscosity. From the temperature, depends on viscosity. Yes, this must be at a particular depth. And I would guess, actually, it will be in the top 300 kilometers, so from 0 to 300. You know, so this might be at 300 kilometers. Yes, Natarajan. How is it different? I don't know that anyone's used stress-dependent viscosity, so I wouldn't know. Dead? Actually, I don't remember for sure that it said 300. It was just a guess. Yeah. So maybe it's 1/5. It's something that certainly has to include continents, where you've asked that the continents be very cold. Or maybe, you know, it has roots that are 300 kilometers deep and very, very big. Okay. I'm done.